The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, March 2020, Volume 21, Number 3. And this is the first of four installments. This month's cover is a close-up of Oprah, who's looking straight at the camera, smiling. She's wearing round glasses with a thin silver frame. Her hair is tightly pulled back from her face, and she's wearing a black turtleneck. This month's headline is a quote from Oprah. "I'm always amazed by how easy it is to impact another life. 31 ways you can make a serious difference." And here are Oprah's opening comments this month. "Sometimes the smallest idea, the quietest gesture, the most ordinary action can pick up steam and become a force of nature. This month we're exploring the ripple effect, and we found 31 surprisingly easy ways you can do a little thing that makes a big difference in someone else's life, not to mention your own. A while back, we welcomed you to the plus-size fashion revolution with a story that proved you don't have to be thin to be chic. I'm now delighted to show and tell you that the beauty industry is realizing you don't have to be young to be absolutely gorgeous. Yes, women with faces past 40 are finally getting the attention they deserve, and you can see for yourself on page 51. If you're anything like me, you're more than ready for spring and the fresh start it always seems to bring. This month's O-List will take you there with great ideas for freshening up your home and your life. We've also got a radicchio recipe straight from my kitchen, a few thoughts from Cheryl Strayed on not allowing your dream of success to get in the way of being successful, and new science on food and mood. Read on." And there's a picture here of Oprah dressed in her cover attire with the photographer whose back is to us, and he's got his camera aimed at her. She's holding one hand up, pointing at the photographer. And let's head over to the reading room and look at 10 titles to pick up now. The first one is Verge by Lydia Yaknovich. In spellbinding stories by turns light and dark, allegorical and realist, Yaknovich experiments with plots involving illegal organ harvesting and transplanting the 15th century artist Hieronymus Bosch to the present, where he conducts a torrid tryst with a gorgeous man. The second title, Unfinished Business, Notes of a Chronic Rereader by Vivian Gornick. In sparkling, fine-cut prose, the extraordinary critic offers an ode to the authors who remain her touchstones, among them D.H. Lawrence, Marguerite Duras, and Thomas Hardy. The third title is Weather by Jenny Offel. The author of the genre-shattering Department of Speculation returns with another work of sardonic fiction, this one about a middle-aged librarian whose anxieties over climate change and whether her brother will relapse into drug addiction expose many of our culture's raw nerves. Number four, The Watergate Girl, My Fight for Truth and Justice Against a Criminal President by Jill Winebanks. The MSNBC legal analyst's vivid memoir recreates her role as the only female attorney appointed to the Watergate prosecution team, where she forged a case for the impeachment of Richard M. Nixon. The fifth title is Real Life by Brandon Taylor, a blistering and tender campus novel. Think Wonder Boys meets Dear White People, centered on a black biochemistry grad student trying to balance the rigors of academia and a tempestuous affair with a supposedly straight white man. Number six, I Know You Know Who I Am by Peter Kispert. The stories in Kispert's wryly scathing debut, including one in which a man hires an actor to pose as an old friend to show his current partner he isn't a sad loner, reveal how we so often make others complicit in our self-deceptions. The seventh title is Saint X by Alexis Skatekin. On a family vacation to the Caribbean island of Saint X, a lovely nowhere, an 18-year-old American is found murdered, sparking a media frenzy. Skatekin's pulse pounder of a novel picks up 2 decades later when the victim's younger sister crosses paths with the lead suspect. The eighth title is The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill family and defiance during the Blitz by Eric Larson. If you thought there was no more to be learned about the great Prime Minister who steered Britain through World War II, think again. Here, the celebrated author of The Devil in the White City transmutes familiar history and new scholarship into an enthralling page-turner. The ninth title is The Regrets by Amy Bonifans. A girl encounters a ghost on a Brooklyn bus and falls head over heels in this witty update of the Bridget Jones-esque rom-com in which soulmates bond via, quote, perfect consonance, zero conversation, end of quote. And the tenth and final title is The Illness Lesson by Claire Beams. Set at an all-girls school in 1870s Massachusetts, designed to teach its increasingly unruly pupils to be, quote, true partners to their husbands and true mothers to their children, end of quote. Beam's first novel is a meticulously crafted suspense tale, seething with feminist fury. And now we'll go to the big O, the special feature section of the magazine. And the first page this month, we're looking down at some white coffee cups on a dark green marble countertop. And the cups have something green and frothy in them, but they have white like cream. This is almost like when you get your fancy cappuccino and the barista has done some creative artwork by just doing fancy, dragging like a little chopstick or something through the cream and making designs. Well, this time we have the Oprah O, and a couple of other cups have those fancy little designs in them. March 2020. If you want to improve our world and your outlook, stir up some positive change. We've found dozens of ways to get started right now. The opposite of hopelessness, it's helpfulness. Here are 31 game-changing ideas that will empower you to aid a neighbor, heal the planet, or hone your routine so that your everyday activities from shopping to vacationing serve a higher purpose. Try a new one every day in the month of March, or pick a few that resonate wholeheartedly and commit. You never know how the action you take might enrich your life, improve your world, and inspire others. Number one, serve up some leftovers. Just over 11% of American families don't have enough to eat, but 40% of the food in this country ends up in the trash. That math just didn't add up for Robert Lee, the son of Korean immigrants, who was raised in a food insecure household in Queens, New York. He launched Rescuing Leftover Cuisine, which crowdsources volunteers to ferry extra food from restaurants, shops, and schools to homeless shelters, soup kitchens, and other charitable organizations. And those extras add up. In 2019, the organization redirected 1.9 million pounds of food, or roughly 17 tons per week. The group operates in 16 cities from Amarillo, Texas to Seattle, with volunteers signing up online to staff pickup and drop-off events near them, cutting waste and feeding the hungry in an hour or less per session. Number two, feel indestructible. Want to buy a bag that's built to last forever? Rewilder takes unrecyclable industrial materials like NASA airbags and seatbelts and turns them into tote bags, backpacks, and raincoats. Number three, take it back. The things you love today don't have to be landfill-bound tomorrow. Beauty companies, including Kiehl's, Lush, and MAC, offer freebies to customers who bring in used packaging for recycling. Levi's and Madewell will give you a discount on or cash toward new jeans in exchange for your old denim. And the North Face and H&M accept any type of clothing and repay you with a coupon to use on their brands. Number 4, welcome a refugee. For proof that refugees make America great, see Albert Einstein, Madeleine Albright, Marc Chagall, or Gloria Estefan. If you use Google to research them, you can thank the search engine's refugee co-founder, Sergey Brin, whose family fled anti-Semitism in Russia when he was a child. The least those of us who were born here can do is act as a greeting committee for our newest neighbors in Iowa, Michigan, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Vermont. The U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants trains mentors to help newcomers learn English, get a local library card, and even navigate the grocery store. You can teach job skills, act as a reading buddy for a child, assist parents in setting up a new home, or drive someone to an appointment. World Relief partners with religious and civic organizations in 10 additional states to provide similar services to incoming Americans. Number 5, clean up to help out. Here's a condo can do. Fill an empty box from online purchases with gently used toys, clothes, or household goods. Then visit givebackbox.com and print out a prepaid, read that, free to you, shipping label. Tape up the box, slap on the label, schedule a USPS or UPS pickup, and GiveBackBox will donate your items to charities that sell them to fund community philanthropies such as job placement programs. Number 6, leave a legacy. Freewill.com makes it easy to complete a rough task, drawing up a will. After you fill in a form on the site, the info is converted into legalese. You sign it in the presence of witnesses, and ta-da, you've got a last will and testament. The process is funded by nonprofit organizations, and the site makes it easy to donate to them and other charities from your estate, an option 90% of people who have wills overlook. It's a win-win that lets you save money on legal fees now and spend it to help others after you're gone. One that's raised over $920 million and led to more than 86,500 wills since launching 3 years ago. Number 7, get creative. When my son Leo joined his school sustainability club in second grade, we traded plastic straws for metal ones, got a composting bin, and battled fruit flies each time we tossed in banana peels, and thought deeply about litter. Our efforts were not enough. Mama, said Leo, now 8, I want to find my own way to help the earth. He decided to think outside the socks. Needle and thread in hand, he launched Those Darn Socks, a service through which the 60 or so residents of our building can leave their threadbare socks and a 25-cent fee in an envelope at our door and get them back the next day, carefully fixed by Leo, who says, quote, if you can recycle bottles, you can reuse socks, end of quote. We all know socks aren't enough, but it has gotten our neighbors to consider whether new life could be breathed into something else they might toss out. Or so says Leo's best customer, the retired geologist in apartment 311. And that was from Kathy Alter. Number 8, turn on the water. After hearing that the city of Detroit was cutting off the water supply to 100,000 residents who owed money on their water bill, Tiffany Ashley Bell started the Human Utility, which lets you donate money toward unpaid balances in Michigan and Maryland to get the service turned back on, a move that can be life-changing for the sick, the elderly, and families with kids, since children are often removed from homes without running water. And now, number 9, run for their lives. After becoming the first amputee to complete the New York City Marathon, Dick Traum founded the Achilles Track Club, a nonprofit devoted to helping people with disabilities gain strength and confidence through running. Nearly 40 years later, Achilles International trains volunteers worldwide to work out with and provide running guidance to disabled children and adults, as well as wounded veterans who want to train for a marathon or just jog around the park. Number 10, write a note. If you haven't had a pen pal since middle school, but remember the thrill of opening each letter, bust out your ballpoint and make the world a less lonely place. You can correspond with a member of the military deployed overseas through Soldiers Angels. Write to an immigrant awaiting processing in a detention facility through Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Or send a card to a pediatric cancer patient through the Tyler Robinson Foundation. Number 11, stop junk mail before it starts. Save trees, time, and your mail carrier's back by visiting optoutprescreen.com, where the Fair Credit Reporting Act empowers you to refuse credit card and insurance mailings for 5 years or forever. Number 12, share your passion. As an author, I believe in buying new books, says Mary Pauline Lowry, but the co-inhabitant of our 400-square-foot duplex, my husband, believes my hardcover habit creates an obstacle course and fire hazard that could land us on hoarders. When the stacks of books rising from our floors make it feel like the walls are closing in, I load up my backpack, hop on my bike, and head from one little free library in my neighborhood to the next. Dumping a bin at Goodwill would be more efficient, but a lot less fun. I imagine each book is a gift to my neighbors and try to tailor the present to their tastes. I leave my hippie reads, volumes on magic and advanced vegetarian cooking I failed to master, at the little free library outside the Boise Co-op Natural Grocery Store, where I once spotted a shopper nabbing my old cookbook. We got to talking, and she gave me a great recipe for sautéed beets. The little free library by the patisserie is often stuffed with children's books, so I add breezy rom-coms to amuse tired parents. And because the one near Camelsback Park has the highest foot traffic, I drop off buzzy new releases there to up the chance that a passerby will spot a novel that's on her to-be-read list. The best part of my route isn't the fresh air, the exercise, or returning home to cleared floor space. That part's for you, honey. It's biking back a month later to discover which gems have disappeared. I see my brilliant friend found a new home. I think wondering which of my neighbors is turning Elena Ferrante's pages, enthralled as I once was. Number 13, be a dog's best friend, at least until they meet their forever human. Foster-based rescue organizations help keep animals out of high-kill shelters by finding them temporary homes until they're adopted. Muddy Paws Rescue in New York City organizes volunteers to not only foster pups, but also take them to the vet and stage adoption events. Lucky Dog Animal Rescue does the same for canines and cats in the D.C. area. And in the Twin Cities, volunteers as young as 12 can help host a puppy party for pet seekers and dog lovers through secondhand hounds. If you're ready for a longer relationship, volunteer puppy raisers bring up dogs until they're old enough to be trained as service animals for people who are visually impaired. The Guide Dog Foundation has programs in 11 states. Number 14, just listen. Be the loving adult a kid in crisis needs. The Trevor Project trains volunteers to answer texts and chat messages from LGBTQ youth struggling with issues ranging from coming out to depression to suicidal thoughts. In New York City and Los Angeles, staffers answer calls 24/7. And advocacy volunteers address the problems from a legal standpoint. For instance, researching laws and filing briefs to help protect young people from conversion therapy. Number 15, spare a quarter. Apps like GiveTide and ChangeUp round your credit or debit card purchases to the next dollar, then donate the extra cents to your chosen charity. You can input a weekly cap at which the function stops and also submit your offerings as tax deductions. Number 16, enjoy VIP status. That's volunteers in parks, and it's what the National Park Service calls the almost 250,000 folks who pitch in at our 419 national parks and monuments each year. At volunteer.gov, you'll find opportunities to use your skills to do things like remove non-native plant species from Hawaii's Volcanoes National Park, allowing local flora to grow, demonstrate hand quilting at the Homestead National Monument of America in Nebraska, or translate and transcribe recordings of immigrants who arrived in the U.S. from the 1890s to the 1930s for the Ellis Island Discography Project at the Statue of Liberty National Monument. Number 17, throw a boomerang. Metaphorically speaking, that is. Turns out volunteering doesn't just have a positive ripple effect on others. It also comes back to benefit you. Researchers at the London School of Economics found that people who volunteer weekly are 16% happier than those who don't. A study published in Psychological Science reported that those who spend time helping others end up feeling, quote, more capable, confident, and useful, end of quote, says head researcher Cassie Molnier-Holmes, and as if they have more time rather than less. Another study in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health showed that adults age 50 plus who give back live longer than those who don't. To find an opportunity that could be your mood lifter / fountain of youth, visit nationalservice.gov. Number 18, get looped in. In 9 states and D.C., you can save time, money, and the planet by joining Loop, a cutting-edge service that delivers your staples from cold brew to shampoo in reusable containers in a Loop tote at your door. When you've used what's inside, place the empties in the tote, schedule a UPS pickup, and Loop will take back the containers and drop off refills. 19, breathe easier. Talk about mothers on a mission. In 4 states, Moms Clean Air Force is fighting for 100% clean energy by 2050. Support them by going online to sign the group's petitions, learn how to contact state officials, or join one of multiple grassroots programs. Community RX, an environmental justice campaign, works with African American churches and neighborhood groups to fight air pollution in underserved areas. Ecomadras tackles environmental health issues affecting Latino communities. 68% of Latinos in the U.S. live in a location that doesn't meet federal air quality standards. Moms and Mayors connects parents with city officials and encourages mothers to run for office in order to create innovative, effective climate and clean air solutions. And Baby Power educates new parents about the importance of safe air and how to advocate for it. Number 20, hang with the OG crew. Why not get to know some of the longest-standing members of your community? In Portland, Oregon, Store to Door organizes participants to pick up and deliver groceries to seniors who can't easily shop on their own. In New York City, you can visit seniors in hospitals or at their homes through Encore Community Services. Nationwide, if you register on elderhelpers.org, you can volunteer to give a ride to, clean house for, or just keep company with a new old friend. 21. Lend your brain to science. Uncle Sam needs you to help out with his science projects. The U.S. government is outsourcing data collection to everyday Americans all over the country in an effort to improve our landscape. To pitch in, browse the catalog of projects at citizenscience.gov. The required skill level ranges from easy breezy, using your phone to upload photos of ladybugs, to the Lost Ladybug Project to help scientists solve the mystery of why the native nine-spotted variety is disappearing, to AP Bio level hands-on data gathering, Project Monarch Health will mail you a kit and instructions for catching monarch butterflies and caterpillars and testing them for harmful parasites. You can participate while you're on vacay, tracking blooms in Joshua Tree National Park for its iNaturalist Wildflower Watch program, or give an assist from the comfort of your own laptop by reviewing and classifying images of kelp photographed from space for floating forests. Because computers can't, quote, see, end of quote, kelp the way the human eye can. Or using Google Street View to scan neighborhoods in Seattle, D.C., Columbus, Ohio, Newburgh, Oregon, and Mexico City to evaluate them for wheelchair accessibility for Project Sidewalk, which identifies problems that need fixing. 22. Play computer games and help end hunger. You're not killing time doing brain games on your phone. You're busy feeding the hungry here, people. The Free Rice app and its website, freerice.com, quizzes you in art, vocabulary, geography, and more. Each time you answer correctly, an ad appears and its sponsor donates to the United Nations World Food Program, which provides food and support services to communities all over the globe. Number 23, take out the trash. I'd heard that food scraps and yard waste make up more than 28% of what we throw away, says Julie Vadnell, and that composting keeps organic matter out of landfills, where it releases methane, a potent greenhouse gas. That sounds great for people who can toss their fruit peels in a corner of their sprawling backyard and months later use the resulting new soil to feed their lush peony garden. But I live in a New York City apartment, so I bought a countertop bin, ordered compostable bags, and started hoarding the sacks full of fruit rinds and molding bread in my freezer. Twice a week, I haul them to the compost drop-off down my street. Even though I studied up on how to compost in a big city, yes to eggshells and coffee grounds, no to oils and meats, I seem to be doing it wrong half the time. Once when the hot bearded guy in overalls stationed at the bins reminded me to check my fruit peels for stickers, I had to remove 3 from one sack. The next week, a fellow composter tried to school me, snarling, "You have to take everything out of the bag." But when I told her mine were compostable, she morphed from judgy green police to friendly earth lover, gushing, "I didn't know about those. Thanks for the tip." Composting isn't bucolic or even easy for me, but it reminds me that we're all in this together, and not one of us is perfect, although the hot bearded guy in overalls comes close. Number 24, do the math. It's census time. Historically, white homeowners are overrepresented. Everyone else is undercounted, and government resources end up being allocated unevenly. The risk is now greater for rural communities without Wi-Fi since the process has gone digital. FairCount aims to make sure this year's census is just that. Sign its Commit to Count form online to become a count captain in your area. Or if you're in Georgia, where FairCount is based, staff phone banks at one of 150 events through July 31st, when the census will be complete. Number 25, have a long-term relationship. Ruthie Thorpe shares this. In my 20s, whenever I moved, I threw away my brooms. Supermarket finds, they were plastic in pickle green or Soviet red. I tossed them because I didn't know how to pack them. I hated them, and I did not yet understand that disposability is an illusion. Now I'm a real grown-up. I move less and try to produce less trash. When I started to phase out plastic and single-use products from my life, I thought it would be unpleasant. Can virtue ever not involve suffering? So I was unprepared for the joy my sustainable items bring me. The bristles of my bamboo toothbrush are longer and finer. My cloth napkins make pizza night feel fancy. But my greatest love of all is my wood and horsehair broom. It cost just $30, but it is a thing of beauty. The horsehair glides across the floor, leaving not a speck of dirt. When it gets grungy, I just shampoo it like I would a horse's hair, and I can wrap it with a wet dish rag to mop. Unlike plastic brooms, if this one breaks, it will eventually biodegrade. But I prefer not to think about that. I love it too much, now and forever. Number 26. People all over America are parking in Siberia at the grocery store, elbowing past fellow commuters on the escalator and printing from the machine farthest from their cubicle, all in an effort to log 10,000 steps each day. If you're one of the nation's 10,000 step maniacs, why not monetize your movement with Charity Miles? The app logs your actions and reports them to corporate sponsors that donate to the charity of your choice from among 45 options. The amount per mile varies by company. You can also join teams to work out together and have friends and family sponsor you. This way, you're not just counting every footfall, but making sure each one counts. Number 27, install a filter. You love how your leggings look and feel, not so much how they leach microfibers into the water supply. Now, Girlfriend Collective, which makes sportswear out of recycled water bottles, sells a filter to catch the tiny plastic pieces that are released when synthetic fabric is washed. Attach it to your machine, empty after every three loads, and throw the filters in the trash. They can't be recycled, but the filter stops them from polluting the oceans. Number 28, give a girl a hand. According to a 2019 study from Indiana University Women's Philanthropy Institute, just 1.6% of all charitable giving in the U.S. in 2016 went to organizations dedicated to women and girls. To increase that number or donate your time, look to the Women and Girls Index, the Institute's public database of philanthropies across the country devoted to serving females of all ages. Invest in Girls, for example, pairs mentors who work in the financial industry with high schoolers to teach them about managing money. Play Like a Girl runs after-school programs and camps that give 9 to 13-year-old girls a chance to play sports because 94% of females in the C-suite did so as kids. And at one of more than 1,500 Girls, Inc. locations in the U.S. and Canada, you can help 6 to 18-year-olds with schoolwork, college readiness workshops, and career roundtables after school and during summer. There are some 45,000 more options to browse to because volunteering with girls today means nurturing strong women for tomorrow. Number 29, play it safe. Made Safe evaluates products from detergent to makeup and grants its seal to those with non-toxic ingredients. It also works with brands to create safer formulations in the hope of eliminating toxic chemicals altogether. Search for Made Safe certified items on its site to protect yourself and others from high-risk pesticides, carcinogens, and endocrine disruptors. Number 30, put down roots. Planting trees that shade your house can cut your energy costs up to 35% by blocking heat in summer and wind in winter. Planting them anywhere reduces carbon emissions, provides a home for birds, and offers climbing, reading under, and swing-hanging possibilities for future generations. Intrigued? Visit the Arbor Day Foundation for instructions on backyard tree growing and become a member to participate in its Time for Trees initiative, whose mission is to fight climate change by seeding 100 million saplings by 2022. Once you join, $15 per year, the foundation sends 10 6 to 12 inch bare root seedlings at the optimum time for placing where you'd like. Watch the organization's YouTube video, Ask an Arborist, How Do I Plant Bare Root Trees, for tips on nurturing your future grove. No yard? No problem. You can have those 10 trees planted in a national forest instead. And finally, number 31, engage in a little monkey business. Here's motivation to smile at a stranger. Quote, we're hardwired to pay kindness forward, end of quote, says Laurie Santos, PhD, a psychology professor at Yale and host of the Happiness Lab podcast. Santos and her team performed the same study on monkeys and four-year-old kids and found that when both were handed a tasty treat or an unappealing food item, then asked to choose what to give the next subject, they usually handed over what they had received. Santos says, quote, we have a tendency to give as good as we get, end of quote. All the more reason to make it something positive. When we turn the page, we have this two-page spread, and it's a close-up of two Navajo women hugging. One Navajo woman has on a silver headdress with inset stones and lots of little images sort of stamped into it, and the seal has what look like arrowheads around a sun setting over mountains, and it says, the Great Seal of the Navajo Nation. The other young woman has on a headdress with some white feathers in it, but it's heavily beaded, like a crown almost. And this is Autumn Montagna, Miss Navajo Nation 2018-19. And Autumn says, my mom always says that when she found out she was pregnant with a girl, the first words out of her mouth were, Miss Navajo Nation. My relatives went to great lengths to get me ready for this title. Since birth, I've been immersed in our heritage. So when the pageant, which has been held every year since 1952, arrived, it was challenging, but I knew what to do. I'd been preparing all my life. Pageantry is incredibly important in our culture, and especially in my family. My aunt was Miss Eastern Navajo and Miss Indian New Mexico. The week-long competition started with each contestant skinning and butchering a sheep. Then there were full days of interviews about what we hoped to achieve during our reign. We also did community service and a public performance where we showed off a contemporary talent. I sang I'm Yours by Jason Mraz and played ukulele and a traditional one, like gardening or making fry bread. The last day was the coronation in front of a sold-out crowd, and I was blessed to be crowned Miss Navajo Nation. The ambassadorship is the winner's full-time job for a year, complete with a salary, an apartment, even a car. I knew from the start that I'd focus on preserving the Navajo language. It's been evaporating for decades. Our reservations have been plagued by alcoholism, domestic violence, suicide. Broken homes mean kids are watched by babysitters who might not pass on our cultural traditions. My father left us when I was little, so while my mother worked to support us, my grandmother took care of me. I was lucky. She taught me so much about my heritage. She was particularly concerned about me understanding Navajo. Still, these days, I struggle to read a long paragraph, which is true of most people my age. That's frightening when I look to our future. After lots of lobbying, we got a big win. As of this year, the kids on our reservation will be learning Navajo in school. And if parents continue to speak to our children in Navajo, sing to them anything, we can reintroduce the language to a new generation. Together, we just might bring it back. It's the work I was born to do. And still in the Big O, we have a contribution from Cheryl Strayed, and it's entitled, Simply Your Best. Practice doesn't always make perfect, as Cheryl Strayed learned while pursuing her dream, but after the grueling climb, she came away with something better. She writes, When I was 4, my mother signed me up for a yoga class at the local YWCA. It was 1972, and not many people were doing yoga at the time, especially not many preschoolers. In the class, the teacher demonstrated pose after pose while we, her incredibly bendy but not so coordinated students, attempted to replicate them. More often than not, the shapes we managed to get our bodies into didn't much resemble those our teacher was modeling, a fact that has remained true for me in yoga classes ever since. She could do this, and we could barely do that. She held herself like a triangle or a boat or an elegantly twisted tree while we teetered and tottered and tripped over our own tiny feet. Try again, she'd say encouragingly each time we tumbled to the carpet. Trying, we soon learned, was not only our central endeavor, but the one our teacher valued most. Yoga, like life, she told us every week, wasn't about achieving the perfect pose, but rather about reaching for it with great concentration. The idea that commitment to the goal was more important than the goal itself struck me at the time, but it was only years later, when I was writing my first book, Torch, that I finally took my teacher's lesson to heart. Like most of the best lessons, it wasn't one that came easily. Ever since I'd learned to read, I dreamed of being a writer, and not just a writer, but a great American writer, which I thought of always and only in capital letters from the very moment I first heard the phrase. I wanted this even though I was a child living in poverty in a family headed by a single mother and had no reason to imagine someone like me could be one. I didn't know any writers, and I didn't have a clue about what being a writer would actually entail, but I had a deep faith in my ambitions. I wrote short stories and read every book I could get my hands on. I fantasized about magically morphing into a glamorous person who lived in New York City so I might have a life interesting enough to write about someday. It didn't occur to me then that I was already leading the life I'd later draw upon in my writing, and that I'd eventually know that every life, glamorous or not, was a story worth telling. I was optimistic but naive, passionate but green. I thought of writing not as a job, but rather a calling. All through my 20s and into my 30s, whenever anyone asked what I did, I told them I was writing a novel. Of course, I did plenty of other things to earn money, waiting tables at restaurants from Brooklyn to Minneapolis to Portland, Oregon, working at a middle school with teen girls as a youth advocate, answering phones and doing data entry as an office temp. But writing was my real job. So I answered that call. I put myself through college and I wrote. I worked a zillion low-wage jobs and I wrote. I grieved the death of my mother and I wrote. I made mistakes and broke up with people and hung out in cafes and hiked and moved across the country and wrote and wrote and wrote. I wrote stories and essays and labored over long sections of prose that I believed would someday miraculously shape themselves into a novel. They didn't. The year I turned 30, I realized that if I was ever going to actually write my book, I needed focus and structure, so I applied to graduate school and accepted a spot in the creative writing program at Syracuse University. By the time I earned my MFA a few years later, I'd written the first two-thirds of my novel. I had only the final part to write, and I felt sure I could. I believed I was in the home stretch. The hardest work, I thought, had been done. A few weeks before starting grad school, I married Brian, a handsome, tender-hearted man who loved to read and talk and walk as much as I did. After I graduated, we moved to a small town in western Massachusetts so he could take a job producing a documentary series for public television. Like me, he'd grown up working class with a single mother. Like me, he'd put himself through school and had student loans he expected to be paying off for decades. Like me, he had big ambitions about his career in the arts and little inclination to make decisions based on financial security. His earnings for his new job would cover only about half our bills, and yet we decided to take a gamble. Instead of getting a job, I'd spend my time finishing my novel. We'd rely on credit cards to make up for what I wasn't bringing in, with the hope that my novel would sell to a publisher within a year and we'd pay off the debt. I remember the feeling I had that first morning when Brian left for work. I was alone in the little cottage we'd rented on a country lane with the fantastic name of Bow Wow Road. I felt ecstatic and lucky, anxious and excited to get to work. At last, I got to be a full-time writer. Finally, I could finish my book. It was set in a rural Minnesota county, much like the one where I'd grown up, and it followed four family members in the year during which the young mother dies suddenly of cancer, as my own mother had when I was 22 and she was 45. If writing was my calling, then the book I'd titled Torch was the story I had to tell, and here was my opportunity. There was nothing in my way. Except, I soon learned, myself, and cable television. I'd never had cable before. I had no idea of the depth and breadth and bizarreness of its irresistible bounty. Soon I was distracted by the constant reality TV offerings, shows about finding love and planning weddings and getting pregnant and preparing for birth and giving birth and renovating your house and renovating someone else's house and organizing surprise parties and interventions and your own atrocious closet. I watched them all. I loved them all. I sometimes did a little preschool-level yoga in front of the TV, or folded laundry, or paged through a magazine to make myself feel more productive. During commercial breaks, I thought about how relieved I was to not be writing my book, until all at once I realized I was not writing my book. Panic, self-recrimination, shame, repeat. In the hour or two before Brian came home from work, I finally forced myself to the computer to write what I could. A page, a paragraph, a line. "How'd it go?" Brian would ask when he walked in the door. "Fine," I'd answer somewhat maniacally, attempting to conceal my shame. Later, I'd lie in bed beside him, awake long after he'd fallen asleep, yelling at myself inside my head. "What's wrong with you? You're almost there. Why can't you do this? You can do this." Until I'd fall asleep on the promise that I'd do better tomorrow. After days turned to weeks and weeks turned to months, I hit bottom. I knew I couldn't go on not doing what I said I wanted to do more than anything. I couldn't go on pretending to be a writer. Something had to change. We often refer to times like this as a dark night of the soul. But it felt to me like the opposite, like the claims I'd made about everything I'd ever wanted to be or do were now under a glaring spotlight. There was no way not to see what was or wasn't happening. Maybe I wasn't a writer after all, I thought. Maybe I hadn't been called. Maybe it was time to let it go. The moment those thoughts came into my mind, I knew they weren't true. I was a writer. I was simply a writer who didn't want to write because I was terrified of failure, of writing a book no one would publish or read or love, of the very real possibility that my novel would not be great or even good. It might be entirely mediocre. There it was, the thing that scared me the most, writing a mediocre book. The only thing scarier was not writing a book at all, I thought glumly, and then that thought expanded into something more gleeful. I could write a mediocre book. The idea was like a flower that bloomed in a field of mud. Perhaps I could get back on track by setting aside my ambitions about being a great American writer and instead surrender to the possibility of my own mediocrity. Perhaps the way forward wasn't to write the best thing that had ever been written, but to write simply the best thing I could. I kept at work on Torch and finished the last chapter a few months later in an artist's colony in Brazil, where I'd been awarded a residency for the express purpose of finishing my book. When I knew I'd done it, typed the last word of the 150,000-word manuscript that by then I'd revised and reworked and reimagined dozens of times, I immediately lay on the tile floor near my desk and wept with gratitude. Torch would be published 2 years later, but I didn't know that then, and in that glorious moment, I didn't care. It was finishing it that mattered to me most, regardless of what happened to it out in the world. Now I could honestly answer yes to the two most important questions. Did I do what I said I would do? Did I give it my all? For me, that was the real measure of success, not the entirely unpredictable assessments others would make of my work. Years later, when my second book, Wild, was published, I was thrilled and moved that it was so well received, but I was also aware of how little that influenced my sense of self-worth. Some called me an overnight success. I wasn't, as it was long before that I'd succeeded in the most important way. When I'd struggled so hard with my doubts and fears writing Torch. Because I'd surrendered to the possibility of mediocrity, I learned the humble power of simply getting the job done. In other words, I finally understood what that yoga teacher had taught me all those years ago. What matters isn't that we attain perfection, but that again and again, with humility and faith, we reach. We'll move over now to the beginning of the magazine in what's called the weigh-in, your take on topics we're covering this month. The first question is, do you know how to use a power drill? 65% said, yep, Chip Gaines got nothing on me, and 35% said no, but I'd like to learn. The next question, breakfast, sweet or savory? And there's a stack of pancakes here. 64% said savory's more flavory, while 36% said sweet on repeat. The next question, if you could have only one, which would it be? We have a really chic sort of pumpkin color short trench coat here. 42% said a chic trench coat. And then we have an off-white simple shirt dress. 58% said the shirt dress. The next question, it's a piggy bank with some dollar bills sticking out of the top. Pink piggy bank, of course. What's your favorite way to give back? 53% said giving my time is sublime, while 47% said, I donate money, honey. And then finally we have a makeup brush in the middle of some pink powder, and it says, do you wear makeup to the gym? 23% say, of course, you never know who you'll run into. And 77% say, no way, I'd sweat it right off. Let's look at the O list as we wrap up this hour. And the first items are some elegant little slippers, and they have this black and white toile pattern. They're fabric with a leather sole. So this, they're pastoral scenes. We have a woman in, we're talking 18th century full skirts and tight bodices with hair piled up on the head. And they're sitting, these two women are sitting under a tree, and one is doing the hair of the other one. Then we have men in their long waistcoats dancing in front of the Arc de Triomphe, it looks like. And then there's a picture of a horse running. So the toile print is just it's generally printed by carving a pastoral scene on wooden blocks, and it's printed just in one color, generally against white. But these have been updated. Around the World in 80 Steps is the heading, Globe Meet Trot. These elegant leather-soled slippers are handmade in Marrakesh and inspired by 18th century French pastoral patterns that have been cleverly reimagined by Sheila Bridges, an acclaimed interior designer in Harlem. Harlem toile Moroccan babouches, originally $135 per pair, now 20% off with code OPRA, SheilaBridges.com. Next up, they've created a colorful display of silicone cooking utensils in gray, indigo, blue, pale coral, and aqua. They have whisks and spatulas and slotted spoons, and they have created them in this sort of wheel pattern. Tool me once is the heading. You don't have to be a top chef to use this premier collection of cooking essentials. Each gadget, including a spatula, a spoon, and why not, a spinula, is heat resistant up to 550 degrees, meaning it won't singe an unsuspecting stirrer. Ultimate 7-piece tool sets, originally $80, now 20% off with code OPRA at GIR.co. Then we've got a stack of towels. They're white, and they have a little blue binding at the bottom, and these have been embroidered with blue O's. Come up dry. What could make a bath better? Having Jason Momoa as your personal bubble pourer? Sure. Or you could just try swaddling yourself afterward in one of these plush, made-in-Portugal cotton towels. They're hypoallergenic, and for an additional fee, can even be embroidered with things like Mrs. Momoa. Piped Edge Starter Pack from $230. WheezyTowels.com. Then we've got some hampers here. Laundry day isn't always fun, but these Italian-made snap-together carriers, constructed from washable paper and available in handsome colors like charcoal and blush, shown here, sure are. Ushmama Modular Snap and Separate Laundry Bags, $138 for a set of two, and you can go to food52.com. So they're just big, square, boxy bags with little cotton binding handles. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.